Welcome, welcome, beloved listeners. This is your ABC, LNL, aka LWP, with PA on RN. And let me now use some other letters of the alphabet to spell out what's on tonight. George Gittos is on. George is going to be talking about his friend Martin Sharp. Now, it's hard to imagine two absolutely more fundamentally different people than George and Martin. George, at the Goya end of graphics, is forever putting himself in harm's way in war zones, from whence he has broadcast for us for this program for many, many years. Martin spent much more of his time rattling around in a strange mansion in Bellevue Hill, a bit like Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. But despite the fact that one, as I said, was towards the Goya end of the spectrum and the other was Andy Warholian, their lives were interlocked, intermeshed, and really quite extraordinary. So, George coming up. And then we're going to return to a story we last dealt with a couple of years ago. We talked to you about William Barak, the Wurundjeri leader who spoke out for his people in what became one of the most notorious government inquiries into Aboriginal land ownership in history. Tonight we tell that story from a completely different vantage point, and I think you'll find it as heart-wrenching today as it seemed to have been right then. But first, East Timor accuses Australia of spying during negotiations over oil and gas reserves in 2004. What a remarkable set of characters. Australian spies masquerading as aid officials. Ex-Liberal Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, who helped negotiate the treaty, ends up a few years later as a lobbyist for Woodside, the Australian gas company that benefited greatly from the Timor Sea Treaty. And on Tuesday, amazing, ASIO raided the Canberra offices of Bernard Kaleri, the lawyer representing East Timor, at the Court of Arbitration in The Hague. Now, the ASIO agents also confiscated the passport of a former ASIS officer who was to be a witness for the Timorese government. Now, the Timorese treaty came into force in 2007. In April this year, the Timor government started arbitration proceedings in The Hague to have the treaty declared invalid, stating that Australia had not acted in good faith by engaging in espionage. Now, the arbitration court began in closed session a few hours ago in The Hague. Joining me to discuss the repercussions of the latest spying allegations are Philip Dorling, national security journalist for Fairfax, and in the Sydney studio, a regular guest on our Little Wireless program, Father Frank Brennan. But tonight we're not discussing the great Jesuit conspiracy, but perhaps a completely different one. Frank, incidentally, has been a legal advisor to the East Timorese government on constitutional issues. Frank, what did you say about ASIO's raid on Kaleri's office that so upset the Attorney General, Senator George Brandis?
I don't know, Philip. He says that I made rather wild and injudicious claims and that I've disappointed him. I've written to him seeking further and better particulars, of course, and I hope he'll be apologising in the Senate because I've looked at what I said and I can't see anything wild or injudicious. But anyway, we'll wait and see, Philip.
Do you think one of the big issues in the story is the perception of a conflict of interest with the former Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, given that he became a lobbyist for Woodside?
That's one of the things that's long been at play in the, what you might call the streets of Dili, Philip. I think the Timorese leadership have continued to draw the distinction between Woodside and the Australian government, but definitely all the years I've been visiting East Timor, there is a popular perception in East Timor that how is it that you Australians do this? For example, it's happened on both sides of politics. Someone like Gary Gray, for example, who worked for Woodside and then ends up as the Minister for Resources and Energy in a Labor government. And then, yes, someone like Alexander Downer, who's there playing a key role in negotiating these arrangements, and then in later life ends up as a lobbyist and has a client by the name of Woodside. So for the Timorese population generally, this has been something which has been a point of confusion.
I'm going to read something you've recently stated. It probably got up the Attorney General's nose as well. What's even more strange is a provision which was put in saying that if the treaty was terminated, that if over time there was exploitation of the reserves, then provisions of the treaty would be resurrected and you would be no longer able to negotiate maritime boundaries. Tell us about the maritime boundaries issue.
Well, this is a complex tale, Philip. In part, you've got to go back to 1972 when Australia negotiated maritime boundaries with Indonesia. And to put it very bluntly, Australia did a very good deal and the Indonesians lost out. But the Portuguese at that time, who had control of Timor, they said, no, we're not going to play that game. And so there was then what was called the Timor Gap, because in the area opposite Timor, there'd been no resolution. So once Timor got its independence, in fact, immediately, the Australians said, well, look, what we need is a treaty where we're not going to determine the maritime boundaries for the moment. In fact, why don't we put them on the long finger for, say, 30 years? And that was putting off the evil day when the Indonesians might realise just how much they'd lost. And what then happened was when there had to be further negotiations about what's called this Greater Sunrise Deposit, there were negotiations from 2004 to 2006. And basically, Mr. Downer put it very bluntly, he said, well, you know, the Timorese want more money, well, fine. Instead of us, Australia, getting 80% of the revenue flow upstream, let's give them 50%. But what do we want in return? Instead of postponing the boundary negotiations for just 30 years, let's postpone them for 50 years. And then they put in what is a very clever little clause that said that even if this treaty were to come to an end, if in the end there was to be a exploitation of the resource, once again that provision about not negotiating boundaries would be resurrected. And so it's a thing which to the Timorese, now being a confident, young, independent nation, they say, why would we want to wait 50 years before negotiating our maritime boundaries?
But Frank, they weren't a confident nation at the time of these negotiations.
No.
They were teetering on the edge of failed state status. They had no money.
Sure.
They still don't have any money, basically, because there hasn't been a flow from the, you know, from these fields. So they copped a bad deal.
They think they copped a bad deal. I mean, in the end, Philip, in terms of the revenue flow, it'll depend on where the boundary finally gets drawn. Now, as I've constantly warned the Timorese, I say, well, you know, with the Sunrise deal, you're offered 50-50. Now, you may get more under a proper boundary delimitation, but you may get less, because Australia's always said if you draw the boundary according to the way Australia thinks it should be drawn, that Australia would get 80%. But that's been left unresolved, and so at this stage, the Timorese are saying, well, look, we do think it's high time that a boundary was negotiated, because otherwise we risk the breakdown of trust.
Now, Frank, I don't know much about the legalities of bugging other nations, but...
Either do I, Philip. I'm a humble Jesuit.
But the ethics the ethics and the morality seem a bit dodgy, don't they?
They do.
And I can well imagine that the Australian government is sorely embarrassed, but the way it's reacting to it only seems to exacerbate the problem.
Yes, there doesn't seem to be much embarrassment. I mean, maybe in part this explains the Attorney General's observation that I've made wild and injudicious claims. My own observation is that I think he's made a very wild and injudicious claim, namely that I've made wild and injudicious claims.
Let's bring Philip in, Philip Dorling. Philip, congratulations. You've had the privilege of being raided by the Federal Police not once but twice. What do you think's the backstory to this? Senator Brandis tells us it's national security. Are you persuaded? Convinced?
Well, I'm unsurprised. I mean, I'm in the unique position of being raided in the course of a leak inquiry by the former Howard government, and then raided again in the course of the Rudd government. When I was raided under the Howard government, the people on the Labor side of politics said, shame, shame, it's a terrible thing. When I was raided under the Rudd government, some people on the coalition side of politics said, that's terrible, fancy raiding a journalist. Governments do pursue leaks, and they pursue leakers, and governments don't make a differentiation in a general sense between...
Well, right at the moment, we've been witnessing massive one might suggest, overkill from the Obama administration on whistleblowers. Every time one sort of puts its head over the barricades, they are really hammered.
Well, I think that's true, and we've also seen some of the biggest leaks of all times, courtesy of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. In this particular case with East Timor, it does appear that from the viewpoint of the government, there's been an unauthorised disclosure of information about intelligence collection, and you know, we don't have all the facts of the case before us, but it may ultimately end up in proceedings in the courts, in either in respect of the Crimes Act or the Intelligence Services Act, because there are provisions that say if you're an intelligence officer, it's not up to you to make a decision about what gets released, and if you do want to release it for whatever motivation, you probably expect that the government will come after you.
Now, Philip, I can't keep you up very late because I know you've got to keep an eye on the door for the next raid, but what do you make of allegations by the PM earlier this evening that lawyers representing Australia in the arbitration proceedings in The Hague reported back privileged information about the whistleblowers gathered from preliminary meetings with the Timorese leaders?
Well, I think that's a serious question that's got to be put to the government in terms of where did they get the information that they've acted upon. Though one thing you could be sure that just as it appears that the government in 2004 thought that the negotiations with the East Timorese about the Timor Gap were an intelligence priority and they were going to use whatever means they could to find out what the East Timorese position was, I would also imagine that they've regarded the current process of arbitration as a priority intelligence target and have probably wanted to find out what the East Timorese legal position and strategy was, and have probably that's featured prominently in the intelligence targeting priorities of the government.
Frank, are the Timorese really using this theatrically, or do they believe that they have a legal case in terms of the original negotiations being subverted?
They definitely think they have a legal case, but I think also what's been at play, Philip, is that they've thought that in moral or ethical terms that the idea of having to postpone boundary negotiations for at least 50 years, that that's just become for them untenable. But then asking what then can be done about it, I think as they've shopped around, asking very prominent international lawyers like Sir Elihu Lauterpacht and Professor Vaughan Lowe from Oxford, they've thought, well, this may be a way to go because of technical legal reasons. Rather than terminating the treaty, if it were said to be invalid, then the 50-year rule would simply go out the window. But I don't think in their wildest dreams they thought they could script this sort of thing. And, you know, I think there are many members of the public, myself included, in Australia, who when being told by Timorese, oh, look, we think our cabinet room was bugged, thought, oh, come on. But when you see this sort of thing going on, you're left saying, well, hang on, what the hell has been happening?
Yeah, and as Philip points out, well, we should point out, we're not simply talking one government. It seems to have been an attitude to industrial espionage exploited by both sides of politics.
Oh, yes, and could I just say, Philip, that, you know, it really struck in my craw last in May when you had Bob Carr and Dreyfus as Labor ministers who issued the censorious press release at the time, basically denying the espionage and saying that it had all been done in good faith. And I thought it was completely unnecessary for them to buy into it because everyone knew that this arbitration wouldn't commence until after the federal election. And some people seemed to think that there was very little prospect that Labor would be returned. So why get involved at that stage? And I think that, in a sense, accounts for Labor's running dead on the issue at the moment.
This is LNL. I'm talking to Philip Dorling and Frank Brennan, and you can see, dear listeners, why John le Carré gave up on spies after military information and went into the whole area of industrial espionage, because that's where the main game is these days. And it is incredibly important, isn't it, Philip, across the world at government level to get the sort of inside trading info when you are doing negotiations, whether it's for, you know, armament systems, submarines, whatever.
Well, I think that's, you know, long theme of diplomatic and history and international relations for a very long time. I think what's changed is that as the technological revolution, the advent of the internet, and the way in which governments, companies, individual people now live their lives connected to electronic systems that generate data relating to virtually every part of their daily lives, that the reach of intelligence agencies, in a sense, across the whole of the globe and then down into the micro detail of societies and governments, but individuals, is quite a revolutionary and transformative thing in terms of the field of intelligence. And it's meant that the ability to gather vast amounts of information and to sift through that and pull out the bits that you want is of being quite a revolutionary nature. And the sorts of legal regimes that govern this activity in democratic countries have got a long way to catch up with the absolute avalanche of advanced technology that's been taking this forward.
Philip, let's circle back to the raid on Tuesday. The government says it had nothing to do with the arbitration proceedings.
Well, I'm sure that the Attorney General, in his own mind and in the advice that he's received from ASIO and from his own department, will have a fairly carefully crafted differentiation and indeed maybe even Chinese walls of some sort. But, you know, Blind Freddy can see that these things are intimately linked, and that they're raiding the lawyer and an alleged source of classified information relating to this legal proceeding with East Timor. It's sophistry from the attorney to try and make that distinction.
Frank, tonight Brander said that The Hague wasn't the best place for the Timorese to solve the problem. Do you agree with the Attorney General, as you do on so many subjects?
Well, he's a learned senior counsel. He may well be right, but given it's the venue that's been chosen and given that each party has gone to great efforts to choose the arbitrators, I would have thought that's what we're left with now. And if you've got, let's face it, Philip, Timor, which instituted the proceedings, I mean, with all respect to our learned attorney, QC, Sir Elihu Lauterpacht is the doyen of international law internationally, and the great Professor Vaughan Lowe from Oxford. I mean, these are not your trendy lefties who come out of Phillip Street. These are people of the most outstanding repute internationally. If they thought this was the way to go, I'd say there's a fair chance that it's at least an appropriate venue. There may be a better venue, but I would think, given everyone is there now, let's make it work.
Philip, it's become a foreign affairs, foreign relations have become very exciting in the last few weeks.
Well, we've been seeing, well, over the last 6 months, we've been seeing a great deal of disclosures in the field of secret intelligence. And indeed, in this country, in Australia, I don't think you've seen so much disclosed about intelligence operations, certainly since the sort of the great days of the 1970s and the mid-1980s, and the National Times newspaper and Brian Toohey and others breaking a whole series of stories. We sort of had about 20 or 30 years of a drought on the intelligence front, but now there's a flood.
I have a sentimental memory of a famous raid on ASIO in the early days of the Whitlam government. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Frank Brennan and Philip Dorling, Philip's national security journalist with Fairfax Newspapers, and Frank is the national security expert for the Vatican. Coming up, George Gittoes, artist, photographer, filmmaker, and collaborator and friend of Martin Sharp. LNL on RN. Okay, let's get stuck into this. As I said earlier, George and Martin seem poles apart from their passion for powerful graphic images. As I said, George is always putting himself into harm's way and rushing off to wars from which he is lucky, I think, to escape and survive, whilst Martin did sit around in that gloomy mansion doing an imitation of Miss Havisham in Gone with the Wind, but not Gone with the Wind. Christ, I've forgotten the name of the play. Great Expectations. But as George is about to tell us, he and Martin were a sort of a strange double act, a Mutt and Jeff. So, George, take us back to your beginnings with Martin.
Well, I came back from a pretty wild New York where I'd been working with Andy Warhol and going out and taking my first photojournalist pictures of the civil rights movement and what was going on in America in 1968, 69. Martin came back from swinging London, where he'd been working with Clapton and the Hendrix posters, and I think he'd had his first encounter with Tiny Tim. And he did that wonderful show in what was the former Clune Gallery. And we were both, this was the Askin Sydney, where nothing happened. And we'd been the two cities of the world which were completely wired. And we both decided we'd go crazy if we stayed in Australia unless we did something. So we got the idea to do the Yellow House in Potts Point. And that was one of the most exciting...
Look, everyone rattles off the Yellow House. I remember the some of the members of the venture, you know, Brett Whiteley, Ellis Fogg, Peter Kingston, and Albie Toms, Peter Weir, Jim Sharman, etc. But to tell the listener what the Yellow House was like if you were to walk through that famous front door.
Well, there still hasn't been much like it. You went in and the walls of the corridor were all recreations from Magritte lithographs, which Martin had brought back from London. And if to the right was our cloud room, once again a Magritte theme room where we had the piano and we do the Yellow House Cabaret, and we did, there were plays like The Beard. And then you'd wind your way up these amazing stairs and you'd come to my puppet theatre, my magic puppet theatre, go a little bit further and you'd come to this combined room that we did with Brett and everyone else, where Brett had his Rembrandt with a huge nose sticking out the door. And and then you'd come into the stone room and everyone would say, shit, man, what was he on? Meaning Magritte, because Magritte was just on surrealism. But it was perfect, you know, the stone room for the Yellow House. And beyond that was the doorway into Martin's secret abode, where he lived. And that was probably the most exciting room of them all.
Well, you talk about Martin being a mystic, always had one foot through the door to the other side. You and he were not alike in that sense, but he was your biggest influence.
Yeah, Martin never did a picture that wasn't from his heart or anything. He was a pure artist and he kept me on the straight and narrow. You won't find any ghettos that were made as flat wall furniture. And Martin's are much more decorative, but they're all pure and you know, they're that spirit. From an artistic point of view, they work like a Mondrian, even if it didn't have Buffhead in it or Ginger Meggs or something. The colours are balanced perfectly and flat colour. And, they're perfect works of art. He told me how to simplify what I was doing, to have a simple message and to clarify it so that people got it easily. In that sense, we were both pop artists.
Okay, now we've talked about, or I've mentioned Martin's mansion. You've talked about the Yellow House. Mm-hmm. Let's look at another venue for Martin, and that was Luna Park, with which he was entirely obsessed.
Yeah, well, that came out of his love of fairground art. Martin, from a child, had collected every kind of toy, particularly Disney toys like Mickey Mouse. Walt Disney was one of his first loves and probably his greatest inspiration as an artist. The exhibition that he had at the Clune Gallery were mainly merging Mickey and Vincent. And so it's natural that when Luna Park got run down, he and Peter Kingston decided to give it a facelift. They got very involved. I went out and did a bit of work there. It was hot, hard work in the sun. And then there was the tragedy of the fire, and Martin
remind people of that tragedy, because it's central to the Sharp story.
Yeah, well, there was a fire in the ghost train, and a group of schoolboys and a teacher were killed, and Martin saw dark demonic forces involved. He felt that it was like being the ghost train. It was a doorway between this world and hell, and it brought a kind of hellish reality into what had actually been a pretty happy space. You know, like from that point on, Wirion had a dark side. Wirion was where Martin lived.
Let's circle back to Luna Park in another of its moments, and that was when Martin chose it as the venue for Tiny Tim, who you mentioned he'd met in London. That was when I got to know Martin more closely, and I'd had some dealings with Tiny Tim. Another magnificent obsession of Martin's.
That was wonderful. Yeah, Martin talks about his work being about the migration of images, and before that, you'd remember he did the Artoons, which are these fantastic pictures where suddenly Marilyn Monroe's face would become a sunflower in a Van Gogh still life. And you'd have Buffhead becoming the thinker, and you'd have the very, you know, strange Edvard Munch pubescent girl sitting on Vincent's pool table from that wild pool hall that he painted. This is sort of reinventing images so that they had a more powerful life than if they weren't put together. And he felt that Tiny did this as well with song. Tiny had the whole history of song in his head. And I was roped into that along with Russell Boyd. I helped shoot that movie and watched it, Martin work on it for years and years and years. When he was young, he loved pinball machines. So I used to think I actually gave him one of my Steinbeck editing machines, that they became like his pinball machine, and just enjoyed watching it on the screen and getting countless editors to keep changing it.
George, you wrote a nice piece about Martin in Time Out Sydney this week, and you said that the gatekeepers never got Martin. Argue that. I thought the gatekeepers all finished up sort of celebrating him.
No, not really. You don't see Sharps in the National Gallery or the Art Gallery of New South Wales. He put his David Gulper little painting in the Archibald, and when I said to people it's the best painting there, I can't remember any of the other paintings from that year. They're all so innocuous. People then puzzled, and they thought, yeah, you're right, but no one would think of giving him the prize. Somehow or other, he was such a maverick that he was seen as outside of the rest of art. I think he was our only great ever international artist.
I've heard this argued, and that is that he's the best known Australian artist internationally, that people mightn't know about Brett Whiteley, and they almost certainly don't know about John Olson, but a great many do know about Martin.
That's correct, and it's interesting. Our idea of Australian art is it has to be the outback landscape, or the, you know, the ocean views of Lavender Bay and this kind of thing. But to have a great international artist, it can be someone who reaches the universal consciousness, and that's what Martin's work did. Like, he was the greatest expression of that psychedelic era, and, you know, the exploding guitar of Jimi Hendrix says it all.
George, I understand the Yellow House, in fact, we've talked about this before, lives on in Afghanistan.
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, it also lives on at Rockdale, and I just did a show tonight. My voice has had it. We've just done the Afghan Book of the Dead in Rockdale Yellow House. And so we've got a company there, and we've also got the company in Jalalabad. I'm heading back there to make a new movie called Snow Monkey, and it's thriving. We've got our circus going out, my little monkey, my performers and so on. And if the insurgency comes back, now that, you know, the Australians have left, the Americans are leaving, we'll be a target. And it's really me being there to back up the artists and hopefully see if this beautiful little oasis of art that we've created can survive a new era.
And in all of this, of course, Martin lives on. Look, thanks very much, George. George Giddes, artist, photographer, filmmaker, collaborator and friend of Martin Sharp, who died on Sunday. We all regret his passing. LNL on RN. It is some years since we discussed Kurrendak Station in Victoria, which has some significance, great significance in Aboriginal history. And I'm delighted to return to it tonight. And we're going to look at the story from a very different vantage point. It was a model farm built in 1863 by the displaced Kulin people, making them self-sufficient, economically independent. But by 1877, the land had significantly increased in value, and the surrounding farmers and the notorious Board for the Protection of Aborigines decided they wanted to take it over for themselves. Now, with the threat of being displaced again, the men and women began a protest that included petitions and letter writing. In fact, their lobbying triggered a parliamentary inquiry in 1881, making it one of the first sustained campaigns for justice, land rights, and self-determination in colonial Australia. And surprise, surprise, it didn't have a happy ending. Now, the story has been developed into verbatim theatre, and I want to discuss this with its co-authors, Giordano Nanni and Andrea James. Giordano, first of all, verbatim theatre is, I guess, exactly what it says. It's the reading of official documents.
Ah, yes, that's right. Verbatim theatre, or in this case, also known as tribunal theatre, where specifically the documents come from judicial proceedings. And it's quite a rich tradition. Quite a few famous trials have been reenacted, like the Nuremberg trials, the Hutton Inquiry in England. But Kurrendak, this play that we've been working on, is very different in that regard, because it brings back to life an inquiry that very few people know about. It's not a well-known event, and so it's bringing it back into the public sphere.
The voice of Giordano Nanni, his fellow at the University of Melbourne, he's in our Melbourne TARDIS. Andrea James is artistic associate at Carriage Works and is in the Sydney studio. Andrea, tell us about your involvement, because as a Yorta Yorta woman, it's also a personal journey for you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I met Giordano, oh, I guess about 4 years ago this journey began, but of course it began a lot earlier, as he was reading the minutes of evidence as an historian and contemplating all of the evidence and the characters and thinking about it being a theatricalisation. So I was working at the Koori Heritage Trust at the time as a community arts worker. And I met Giordano at that time, and he started talking about these extraordinary transcripts and the possibility of them being theatricalised and reenacted again. So I guess that's where our creative journey began.
Giordano, there were similar struggles taking place at other Victorian reserves. So what was it that distinguished this struggle?
Oh, that's a very good question, and it's really important for us to remember that other struggles just as powerful and long-lasting took place at Framlingham, Lake Conda, Lake Tyres, later at Cummeragunja. I guess what distinguished Kurrendak is that it was the success of the campaign there, was that the people under William Barak, the women and men of Kurrendak, waged their campaign very publicly. They managed to get their voices into the press. They managed to, first of all, they were close to Melbourne. Kurrendak was only about 60 kilometres from Melbourne, whereas most of the other reserves and missions were too long to walk. So the men and women could form deputations. And then, of course, they got their words into the inquiry, which was unprecedented. No other protest had resulted in such, had mobilised such political force to create that kind of response.
Well, the last time we talked about it was when Barack Obama was surfacing. And, of course, one couldn't help but point out the fascinating similarity of the names, yep, of William Barack. But also the fact that he was a charismatic leader and clearly a very good person.
Absolutely. Andrea, do you want to jump in here? I think
Yeah, well, yeah. We talk about William Barak. I mean, culturally, he was known as Narangita, a spokesman, a spokesperson, a very, very important man culturally, you know, for the Kulin and the Wurundjeri. He was an extraordinary looking man. And he also had a great gift and talent for painting. And, you know, in the last 20 years of his life, he painted these extraordinary paintings, which can still be seen today. One of them is exhibited at the moment in London, in the Australia exhibition, Barak's painting of Corroborees. And, you know, it was this extraordinary time, these last 20 years, it was this, he had this burning desire to paint what he saw as a child, these really important ceremonies. So he's left this incredible, incredible legacy, not only within the letters and all of the petitions in which he, you know, led his people. Many times they walked from Corindirk to Melbourne to go straight to the heads of parliament to protest against the treatment, but also to lobby for land rights.
And of course, as I remember, often turned away, ignored, and having to be absolutely insistent and patient and resolute. But of course, that reminds us that the clans who established the station in 1863, you describe as true survivors. Why?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, this is one of the harrowing things that you see in the transcripts themselves, where they actually say, you know, how many Aboriginal people are left in Victoria? And they said about 1,000, you know, and we know that, you know, before the Whitefellas arrived, there was, you know, 60,000 people. So, you know, really, these people were absolutely struggling for survival. You know, to think about my people, the Yorta Yorta people, there were really only 300 people left at that time. I mean, it's extraordinary. And I guess that's what's just so wonderful about this project, that, you know, I'm collaborating with Giordano. I'm a descendant of one of the people that are witnesses within that, the transcripts, Alec Campbell. And, you know, I guess we've survived this really harrowing time. And, you know, I guess Barak and the people were determined to stay on country and to just build up strength as people again.
Sure, Donna, they had a couple of pretty useful white friends, and I'm thinking, of course, of John Green and his wife Mary. John, a Scottish Presbyterian lay preacher, who was instrumental in helping establish that community.
Absolutely. In many ways, this at the heart of Corindirk's success was this collaboration between white and black, which is probably another distinguishing feature between Corindirk and the other reserves. There just wasn't that kind of relationship. It was for the time, it was really quite an egalitarian relationship. In one of the parts of the inquiry, John Green is asked, did you ever have to call the police? How did you manage to manage the blacks, to use the words of the time? And he responds, I always treated them as free men and reasoned with them. I made a law with their own sanction and also fined some of them for drinking. But that was the Aboriginal law, that if any got drunk, they were fined. They were fined and some of them were chastised according to their own law. If the Aboriginal is put into the question, he says, he will strive to keep his own law. That is where I consider you have failed. And then at another point, he's asked whether mixing the blood improves the intelligence of Aboriginal people. And of course, at that time, the standard answer to that would have been yes. And he flatly replies no. So he was, you know, he was quite an unusual character. But it really reminds us that back then there were white fellas who did the right thing, who stood up for what was right. It wasn't just a case of, you know, everyone was thinking alike. Then, as now, there were people who stood out.
But, of course, that made him a target, and the government moves to remove him, doesn't it? The board orchestrates his removal.
Exactly, yeah. Precisely that level of collaboration that exists between white and black doesn't really suit certain power interests, which are more interested in divide-and-conquer approaches. And when the board for the protection of Aborigines, which is essentially hijacked by the local squatter pastoralist establishment via people like Edward Kerr, they see him as a problem, because they try to convince him to move the Aboriginal people. And he says, Again, this is verbatim. I know that I could move them because I can talk to them as men and as brothers, but I will not try, decidedly not.
Andrea, let's look at Edward Kerr, well named, a senior member of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines, self-appointed expert on matters Aboriginal, but he had, bugger all understanding of Aboriginal culture.
Well, yes, and it was, it was rather satisfying as a theatre maker to return to this particular historical figure again, because in an earlier play that I wrote, Yanagai Yanagai, about the Yorta Yorta native title claim, of course we encountered Kerr, and he was one of the first white men to come in and settle on Yorta Yorta country, and he later wrote his recollections of squatting in Victoria, and he really was known at the time or considered as an expert on Aboriginal people, and in fact those recollections of squatting in Victoria was used as evidence against the Yorta Yorta people as well.
Let me clarify this. Recollections of Squatting in Victoria,
yes,
was his memoir.
Yes, that's right, which was written some, 50 years or more, from his contact then as well. So, they were literally recollections, but they were taken as quite gospel in the native title claim.
Any redeeming features, Andrea?
Of Kerr?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he was on the Aborigines Protections Board, but ultimately he had vested interests. I mean, his family had massive land holdings. I think they began in Tasmania. They had land holdings in Ballarat as well, and then of course they went up to really conquer that area on my father's homelands around Cummeragunga on Yorta Yorta country. So, the interests were absolutely vested. He wanted to have as much land, and he was capitalising off our land, and yet here he was on the Aborigines Protection Board encouraging the Corindirk people to be moved off so that white people could go in and take over the land. I mean, it's incredibly fertile land right on the river there, perfect. And,
If I could just jump in, there's a really another important point that Andrew, of course, is very familiar with, is that Edward Kerr's recollections of squatting of Victoria was then used only recently in 2000 by High Court Justice Howard Olney as evidence in the Yorta Yorta native title claim. So even though Edward Kerr died back in the 1890s, his words continue to have an impact on the descendants of the Yorta Yorta. And of course, Andrew James can probably talk more authoritatively about this, as she even made a play about this very incident. But Edward Kerr, in a sense, continues to talk today in our courts. And those that have followed the case know that in the end, Justice Olney upheld or denied the Yorta Yorta native claim based largely on the evidence of Edward Kerr.
Keith Windschuttle would love this story because, of course, he's a great believer in the written record as opposed to oral traditions. Andrea, let's look at a couple of other prominent characters. Tell us about the widow of Wappen.
Oh, Anne Bonn, what an extraordinary, amazing woman. And, I mean, she was quite a remarkable woman from her time. I mean, she married a much older man who I understand was going to propose to her mother and then her sister, and so she ended up taking up the offer, and luckily she did, because he was a very well-off man and they had large land holdings on Wappen, and a lot of Aboriginal people would come and shear sheep, and that's where she developed relationships with Aboriginal people and a lot of concern. And of course, when her husband died, she inherited all of this land and quite a lot of wealth. And she had a home in Kew. She was quite an established woman and very, very influential and very outspoken. And she developed an incredible relationship with William Barrack as well, and really advocated for the people. She could see, she could see what was going on. She could see and understand the machinations that was going on with the Aborigines Protection Board. She was very dissatisfied with what was going on and, really lobbied, got the people, a doorway into the the powers that be. And also she was very clever in lobbying, you know, the newspapers of the time as well, and reporting things in the Argus and writing letters as well, and really agitating. In fact, I think Strickland, the manager of Corranderk at one stage, called her a wicked woman. You know, she was very outspoken and incredibly so for the time that she was speaking in as well.
Tell us about Thomas Dunbally, who was only 25 when he testified.
Yeah, he was a really interesting man, and you know, I think what's so interesting about Corranderk is that the young people that came through, they took up writing skills, and so really, you know, William Barrack and Simon Wonga, you know, English was their second language. And so Thomas Dunbally was very important in that he was getting down the words. You know, literally Barrack was reciting to him or saying what we need to say to the white fellas, and he was writing it down in English. So he was a really important conduit for the older people, for the elders, a representative for the elders.
You know, when I first became aware of this story, you know, 20 years ago, I guess, I was dumbfounded, gobsmacked, that we didn't know about it, that it had evaporated from written history. It's not a part of the school curriculum, for example, is it, Giordano?
No, it's not, and that's exactly where we hope this project will really work one of its most important functions. I had exactly the same reaction as you. I was born in Italy, and I came out to Melbourne early, about 11 years ago, and I learned about the story almost immediately after I came, and I assumed, because it is such an incredible story, I assumed that everyone would know about it. And literally when I realized how little known it was, it really, first it shocked me, and then it seemed like a real injustice. And I think that that's what's really driven not only me, but everyone that's come on board this project and has worked so hard, has really been motivated by the sense that this story just needs to be better known. And one of the ways in which we're doing this is through a project that's called the Minutes of Evidence Project, which is as quite a large project fund, and it's been funded by the Australian Research Council, the ARC, and it includes the University of Melbourne, the Department of Education, Arts Victoria, Ilbidgery Theatre Company, which of course has played a key role in all of this by putting on the performance. They're the oldest Aboriginal theatre company in the country. And Rachel Mazza and Isaac Drandage, who have directed the performances, have been crucial. So have La Mama Theatre and various other partners.
It's wonderfully credentialed, isn't it?
It is.
And very eclectic in its connections.
We really hope at the moment what's happening is the Department of Education is preparing curriculum that will accompany the play and really help to help teachers to use the play as an educational tool. I mean, theatre is just so engaging. It's such a great way of engaging with kids, and kids know so well. They can spot unfairness and injustice so quickly. We really hope that they'll engage with this story and through theatre, and really make a change so that people do grow up knowing about the story.
Let's circling back to the notion of verbatim theatre, Andrea. It's you know, to the untrained ear, it sounds easy. You just read bits out, but it'd be rather like turning a couple of volumes of Hansard into a miniseries. How did you do it?
Oh my God! You know, look, it was an extraordinary process, and the transcripts are very, you know, they're very lengthy. There are a lot of witnesses, but you know, ultimately, I think Giordano and I, you know, the real characters and the real plots and subplots that were coming out were actually quite obvious in the end, and so it was really a case of going, oh gosh, that's an interesting story, and I can see and hear that on the stage, and you know, and drawing them out. We did order things around to, you know, to kind of get a sense of climax, and to, you know, I mean, because the challenge was ultimately in a inquiry like this, it's just question answer, but really the beauty of it is that the audience don't know what character is going to come up next, and you know, as eclectic as all of those stakeholders are in this particular project, as were the witnesses, you know, so many varied witnesses, and each one came at it from a different angle. So it was just a fascinating process.
Andrea, I take it that the cast members have to double, triple, quadruple up to fill out the characters.
They do, and it's beautiful to see, and audience members really enjoy that as well. You know, as you say, the doubling and tripling of characters, and the next version that's about to open next week at Belvoir, it's an all Aboriginal cast this time, and they, you know, Aboriginal actors will be playing non-Aboriginal actors, and I think there's been this real
joy. That is absolutely outrageous.
It is, isn't it?
That's heavens above. That's, you know, we had a proud tradition of white actors playing Aborigines. Now you're turning the tables.
Well, we are trying to take over the world, as you know.
you and the Jesuits, yes. How does the stage look?
Oh, well, you know what? I haven't seen it yet. We're going to see a run tomorrow. So, I don't know. I don't know what they're cooking up as yet. They're going to keep it pretty simple. They've got a screen that comes in and out. So it's a bit of a postmodern approach for this next.
Well, I love the sound of it. I just think it's terrific. Mm. And of course, Giordano, there are so many other stories which are available for telling through the same creative methodology.
That's right. I mean, one of the beauties of this is that one of the ironies as well is that this evidence was collected by the Empire, and they were very efficient at collecting evidence. So there are minutes of evidence of colonial inquiries scattered around the world which could be used in a similar way. And one of the beautiful things about this is that the colonizers' archive is being redeployed to, you know, reveal the injustice of colonialism, whereas originally it was used perhaps to justify. Now it's used more to expose. And it's really, I mean, I think one of the other powerful things about people hearing these words is that they get direct access to this historical evidence, and they get to really have a go at interpreting it for themselves. We bypass the Keith Windschuttle history war thing and just go, well, you have direct access to these words and see
who plays Keith Windschuttle in the production. I love the thought of him being played by an Aboriginal actor.
That's a great idea.
Look, thank you. Thank you both. Giordano Nanni, Andrea James, authors of Cotton Deck, We Will Show the Country. Oh, it's published by Aboriginal Studies Press. Performance held at Belvoir from December the 7th to January the 4th. It is now my happy duty to thank the team. Good on you, Stan Curry, Christine Short, Mudita Diaz, exec producer Gerber Saria, technical production from Joe Wallace, and thank you to Mike Pritchard, who helps get me on air when I'm sitting alone up here in Muswellbrook. Coming up next on the news is RN, and we'll see you next week, which will be our last week of live Late Night Lives before we go into our repeats for the summer.
David Higgins is a big infrastructure guy. The man from country Queensland got everything sorted for the London Olympics and is about to take on the building of Britain's high-speed rail network. But he owes it all, he says, to a geologist he met in Africa.
Right, I want you to go across the border to Tanzania, buy illegal gemstones, smuggle them back here, and I'll see you back in 3 weeks' time.
David Higgins, former gem smuggler, current engineer, is on Sunday Profile, and you can download the show from the RN website.